Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. On Christmas Day of 2005, an aging North Sea trawler, painted black, made a headfirst charge into a Japanese whaling ship with the express purpose of punching a hole in it. The Japanese called it an act of eco-terrorism, but the crew of this trawler said that it was the Japanese whale hunters who were the real terrorists, and the environment, they said, was the victim. Today on Focus 580, we'll be talking with Peter Heller. He's a journalist who happened to be along for the ride on that day. In his book, The Whale Warriors, he profiles the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a group that says only radical direct action can save the whales and ultimately the rest of the planet. The book is recently published by the Free Press. The subtitle is The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals. And as we talk this morning with Peter Heller, you certainly are invited to call in with comments and questions. Peter Heller is an award-winning adventure writer. He's a longtime contributor to National Public Radio. He is also contributing editor at Outside Magazine and National Geographic Adventure, and his writing appears frequently in Men's Journal. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, certainly, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just are brief as they can be when they call in so that we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, listeners are welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening on the air around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening on the Internet, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Heller, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
You bet.
We appreciate it. Tell us a little bit more about that day, Christmas morning 2005.
Well, the ship called the Farley Mowat, named after the famous and beloved Canadian writer, had left Melbourne, Australia on December 10th. Heading due south, picked up a helicopter in Tasmania on the way, and this is a 180-foot converted North Sea trawler, painted all black, as you said, bristling with water cannons, flies under a Jolly Roger, and on the side of the superstructure, the part of the ship that, you know, goes up to the bridge, are painted rows of skulls and crossbones with the names of ships, the Maril, the Isba 1 and 2, the Sierra, and these are ships that have been rammed and sunk by the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society whaling boats. The society claims the sinking of 9 whaling ships to the bottom of the sea, so they're pretty serious. And about 2 days south of Tasmania, the welders came on deck and welded a large blade to the bow of the boat called the can opener. And I think that's when I realized that the assignment was very serious. And their mission was to hunt down and stop, by almost whatever means, the Japanese whaling fleet in its commercial whaling that the Sea Shepherd deems illegal. There's been a moratorium on commercial whaling since 1986. Mm. The Japanese use a loophole for scientific research. Countries are allowed to set their own quotas and kill whales for quote-unquote scientific research. The Japanese just happened to kill 935 minke whales and process them on a factory ship, and the meat then goes to restaurants and school programs. So Sea Shepherd saw that this isn't illegal commercial whaling. They were going to stop it by whatever means necessary. And so they headed straight for the Antarctic ice edge, searching for the fleet. They were looking for the Japanese in an area the size of the entire western United States, 1.5 million square miles. So their radar only went out to about 20 miles, effectively. So imagine the sort of quixotic sort of mission that they had to even find the Japanese whaling fleet. And this is on an old 50-year-old trawler that goes about 9 knots. The Japanese fleet can move at about 16, so they were sort of outsped as well. Imagine getting in, you know, your truck, say, in Urbana, and thinking that you want to find a semi-truck and a convoy with it of maybe six pickups in an area the size of Western United States. You know, where do you go? And Watson, we had been so we've been at sea just over 2 weeks. As we got down towards the ice edge of Antarctica, we hit a force 8 gale, and it was terrifying. The seas were, you know, 30 to 40 feet. Winds were, you know, 60, 70, 80 knots, and there was ice in the water. And this old hull had been patched and repatched. So here's this, you know, ship looking for the Japanese. And then on dawn on Christmas morning, we sort of just ran into them out of the fog. Greenpeace had two ships down there. They were also trailing the Japanese whaling fleet, and their mission was to sort of document and protest. They wave banners, they protest, they wave banners that say go back to Japan, stop whaling, stuff like that. The founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, who ran the ship that I was on, Paul Watson, he believes in physical intervention, and he thinks Greenpeace is wimpy, you know, and that you know, protesting really does nothing. The Japanese just keep whaling. So he was going to physically intervene. Greenpeace had been tailing the fleet for about a week and waving banners trying to get in between the harpooners and the whales. And so they were there in the storm with the big factory ship. Watson's ship, the Farley Mowat, this black privateer, came out of the fog right on the tail of the factory ship. Everyone was just sort of idling in these huge waves just trying to ride out this gale. And the Japanese must have seen this ship on the radar. They didn't respond. They just kept going 7 knots into the seas. And they thought that Watson's ship was one of the Greenpeace ships, and they weren't worried until someone on the bridge turned around and saw it coming out of the fog, all black with a Jolly Roger, you know, flying and tattered in the wind. And then they put the pedal to the metal, and they fled. The captain of the ship, this guy Toyama, had been down there whaling for about 30 years. For the past decade, he'd been terrified of Sea Shepherd. All whalers, you know, on the high seas really are. And, you know, finally, you know, here was the Sea Shepherd ship on his tail with his can opener. And I think he sort of snapped. You kind of got that sense, because about a quarter mile away in these big seas, he turned his factory ship, this is about a 500-foot ship, he turned it sideways to the seas and kind of, you know, communicated, okay, if you want to play, let's get this over with. Watson and his first mate on the Farley Mowat, they did not flinch. The ships were heading at their full speeds toward full collision. There was an order on the ship, you know, to prepare for collision in 2 minutes. Their factory ship horn, as we got closer, was blaring. The bow of this Japanese factory ship is 30 feet high. You know, it's 3 stories high, and it was launching airborne over the waves, coming down and tearing huge chunks out of the sea, which vaporized in the wind. Their horn was blaring. The ships were getting closer and closer. They were going to T-bone us. In those seas, we would have sunk immediately, and I doubt anybody would have survived. At the very last second, Watson gave an order. A team on the stern of the ship unleashed a mooring line, a long rope that would have tangled the Japanese factory ship's propeller. And just at that second, the ships were only about 150 feet away. They were just within seconds of colliding. Someone on the Japanese bridge turned the wheel over. The ships came very close, agonizing a few seconds. They went parallel in that big storm, and then the Japanese fled. And it wasn't for another 2 weeks that Watson encountered them again and engaged them again in another insane engagement. Mm-hmm. So.
And one important point here, and it certainly is true that governments have condemned the Sea Shepherds. I'm sure that other environmentalists, whether they're willing to say it publicly or not, don't approve of their methods. And it is what they do certainly endangers the people that they're going after. They also are putting themselves in danger, because it's very possible that not only might they sink another ship, but they certainly could themselves sink. And that's not a place that you're going to want to be in the water anytime at all. So in fact, while they may indeed be risking putting other people's lives at risk by what they do, they're also putting their own lives at risk.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if the ships had collided, I doubt anybody on the... We had 45 people on the Farley Mowat. I doubt anybody would have survived that. And the interesting thing about his crew is that everybody on that ship, except a few journalists who were there just to document, like myself, everybody on that ship was ready to die, you know, to save a whale. What they thought was if the factory ship did collide with and sink the Farley Mowat, it would have raised such, you know, international outrage that the Japanese whaling program in Antarctica would have ground to a halt. So they were ready, actually, to sacrifice their own lives completely willingly. And that was sort of, you know, it's sort of galvanizing to be on a ship with, you know, people of that kind of commitment. In some ways, it's very inspiring. In some ways, it's a little frightening. Watson has been called a, you know, terrorist and a pirate by, you know, several sovereign nations, including Norway, the whaling nation of Norway. The Soviet Union, when there was one, almost, you know, blasted one of his ships into the Bering Sea. Even the Fisheries Agency of the United States has called him an eco-terrorist, as has the FBI. On the other hand, he has 5103C status as a nonprofit organization in the United States. So it's a very interesting sort of gray area that this guy moves in.
That's, I guess, one of the things that I don't quite understand is how is it that, given the fact that I'm sure that a lot of nations consider what he does an act of piracy and aren't hesitant to say so, that he hasn't been arrested?
Right. Well, I think there's a few reasons for that. He's a master sort of politician, you might say, in that he understands that the countries that are whaling, most significantly right now, Japan, Norway, and Iceland, which has just suspended its new commercial whale hunt because there's been a lack of demand, actually, for the meat. But these three countries, you know, have been commercially whaling for a while under the moratorium that was established in 1986. And they understand that were they to tangle with Sea Shepherd, say, arrest Watson and his crew, indict them, put them on trial, that it would focus even more international attention on their whaling. And, you know, I don't think these countries really want that.
Mm-hmm.
So Watson kind of, you know, he actually has offered to fly himself to Norway. He's, you know, he's been responsible for the sinking of several Norwegian whaling ships. And he's, you know, called him and said, hey, I've got a plane ticket. You know, I'm ready to come put me on trial.
It's, as you mentioned, there is this there is an international ban on commercial whaling. It was put into place back in the mid 80s by a group of 77 nations that regulates whaling, and that there is, though the problem is that there is this loophole that these nations have taken advantage of, and certainly the Japanese have, of doing some hunting for research. And I think that a lot of people, when they look at what the Japanese do, they say, come on, that's completely bogus. Why is it, though, that for example, the International Whaling Commission or some other kind of international body has not said to the Japanese, look, this is not the intent of this law, and we would certainly expect you, if you're going to sign on to this, to abide by the provisions of these regulations?
Right. That's a really good point. The Scientific Committee of the International Whaling Commission since 1986, has lodged over 20 objections to the Japanese quote-unquote research whaling program, saying that the research is not rigorous and that it wouldn't stand up under peer review. So, yes, the Scientific Committee of the IWC has been asking the Japanese to stop this lethal, quote, research. But the problem is, you know, as with many international conservation laws, the problem is with enforcement. A lot of good intentions go into these laws. You know, the Japanese are whaling in the middle of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. This was a sanctuary established in 1994 by the IWC, internationally ordained. It goes from the coast of Antarctica all the way to latitude 40 degrees south. It's absolutely huge. And it ostensibly protects 11 of the 13 species of great whales, complete protection. And the Japanese are, you know, killing all these whales there with impunity. So I think that's what fires Watson's anger, you know, is that, you know, all these laws are made, all this talk, all these, you know, conventions and laws, and then, you know, nobody enforces them. And he feels like, you know, somebody's got to do it. And, you know, his whole mission is to physically intervene to enforce international conservation law.
Yeah, so he thinks clearly the Japanese are breaking the law, and what he's doing is, I don't want to be too casual about it, but he thinks this is like making a citizen's arrest.
Exactly. He cites, it's interesting, he cites the UN Charter for Nature, something ratified in 1982, and Article 21 on enforcement it says groups, organizations, and individuals should ensure that the provisions of the Charter for Nature are upheld. I'm not sure that is a license to, you know, deputize yourself and, you know, be a vigilante and go out and arrest, you know, ships on the high seas. I don't think that was the intention of the law, but that's what Watson uses as his justification for this kind of use of force.
I have a caller here who's been patient, and I want to get them into the conversation here. And also to anyone who might have tuned in here in the last few minutes, I want to introduce again our guest, Peter Heller. He's an award-winning adventure writer, longtime contributor to National Public Radio. He's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine and also National Geographic Adventure. And his most recent book is The Whale Warriors, The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Free Press, and it is indeed a book that profiles the efforts of this organization, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and its founder, Paul Watson. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, the numbers. Here's a caller in Belgium, community not that far away from here, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for killing whales at all, but there's a couple of things I have to point out. Number one, the thing you were talking about, the whale area where they're not allowed to be fishing at, that's the same as Mr. Inge, who's on this show, is right on the 40th parallel north from here to Antarctica, from here to Arctic, which is a long, long, long ways, is how big it is. That's an enormous area.
Enormous.
I don't really realize how huge that is, almost half the planet, but not quite. The other thing is, If I don't like a child molester, I don't have the right to go kill him. I don't see where people could stand by and, I mean, as noble his idea may be, the aspect of killing other people to make it right.
Right. No, of course. And he, I think it's a great point. Watson loves to, he prides himself. He loves to say that he has never, in any of his actions, injured or killed anyone, either on his own crew or on the crews of other ships. And it's interesting. He talks a lot about the sanctity of all life, including people, including Japanese whalers, including whales and seals and fish. He says he loves to say when he's speaking, my clients, he says, I don't give a damn what you think of me. My clients are the fish and the seals and the whales, and if you can find me one whale that disagrees with what we're doing, you know, we'll reconsider. And so, in some ways, you know, it's interesting because he's a pacifist. I mean, he doesn't want to hurt anybody. And his rammings, you know, all the ships that he sunk, the whaling ships he has sunk in port, they use limpet mines, which they put on the hulls of the ships and, you know, blow open a hole in the hull, or they open the sea cocks and scuttle the ship. They search the ships thoroughly at port, and then they sink them. And several times, you know, in Iceland and Norway, they have found, you know, watchmen, you know, drunk in the mess, you know, at a table in the mess, and they just, you know, have left the ship alone. So I think it raises a very good point, though, because I think, you know, one of the points I raise in my book and one of the problems I had, you know, with this whole approach, because I feel very much like you. I feel very strongly that the whaling is wrong for many, you know, legally, ethically, And yet, you know, I very much question this kind of approach, and it's because I think these actions, while they don't intend to hurt anybody, I think when you are ramming ships and fouling propellers on the high seas in gales, in ice, you know, things can go awry and people can get hurt or killed. So, you know, it's a really good point that you raise.
Thank you very much.
Well, did you ask Paul Watson, did you say to him something like, well, amazingly enough, now in all of these actions that you've taken, no one's been killed. How would you feel if someone did, if someone died as a result of your action?
Right. You know, he's very deft. He's a master sort of speaker and interviewer, and the way he deals with that kind of questions is just to say that, you know, we've never done it, and it's not going to happen, and, you know, we're very careful. We search ships. The can opener that he used, as they were welding it on, he kind of, you know, sort of wryly from the bridge as he watched down, looked down at this, you know, I was very concerned about this blade. And he said, it'll just crumple like cardboard when it hits the side of a ship. And when he actually did ram one of the Japanese ships in Antarctica and sent it back to Tokyo because they were so freaked out, when he did ram it, the blade did just crumple up. And what that gave me is an insight into his sort of MO, which is he put that can opener, I think, on the bow of the ship because it is so sensational. Because I would talk about it, you know, on radio. Mm. The press, you know, it would attract attention from the press. You know, this ship with this big blade, you know, ramming ships. And yet at the same time, you know, it's a great PR move. You know, it focuses on what he wants to do. I mean, I think he realizes that, you know, ramming a whaling ship or sinking a Norwegian whaling ship in port is not going to stop whaling. But maybe, perhaps, the international attention focus on the whaling by that action, you know, may create some sort of, you know, some sort of international actions.
Well, let's talk with another caller here in Urbana. Line one.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and it's a coincidence for me because I was catching up on old New Yorkers, and you know this. It's sort of, I don't know if I should bring it up, but on November 5th, Rafi Khachaturian wrote an article about this man, Paul Watson, and the Sea Shepherd. And what I, you know, and I'm going to read your book because I found this one so fantastically adventurous, and this character is such a character. And the fact that he was one of the founders of Greenpeace and then they kicked him out, the fact that he didn't only go after whales, but he went after the hunters of baby seals because that really captured a lot of imagination all around the world, that he went down to the Galapagos, seemingly everywhere, to stop this, and going after corrupt officials in different places. What does your book enlarge in our understanding of all of this? I mean, how does it compare to just this long article?
Right, right, right.
I mean, you know, am I bringing up something that you'd rather not talk about?
Oh, no. I think the article is absolutely excellent. And you know what it does is it focuses, you know, attention on some of these on some of the issues in the Galapagos, the shark finning,
right,
the baby seals in Canada, you know, the whaling. It's an absolutely, you know, it's an excellent article. It's interesting because the article was written, it sort of gives you the impression that the writer was in Antarctica. Sailing with a ship, he wasn't, but he did a very good job of evoking it. And I think the article is great. And I hope there are more and more of these pieces about people like Watson and about the crisis of the oceans. What my book does, it is a high seas adventure. It is a great yarn. I mean, you know, people who have read the book stay up all night. You know, it's a page turner. It's a nail.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah, you get so into the crew. You know, the crew on this ship was Earth First activists. It was former military commandos. It was professional gamblers and Hollywood producers and people with master's degree in environmental consulting. You have these, you know, this very crazy. It was Hell's Angels from Holland. You know, was the ship's artist. That was his job on the ship. Was a Hell's Angel tattoo artist from Holland who spent all day drawing, you know, big-eyed baby seals in a logbook and decorating the ship with, you know, wood cutouts of whales. you had this extraordinary crew on there, and they went off, they launched into Antarctica on this quixotic mission, which became absolutely epic adventure. And that's what my book is. It's a high sea adventure, kind of, you know, as it hadn't been seen. I mean, how long has it been since ships, you know, hunted each other down on the high seas to engage each other in remote areas? You know, it's been a long time. And then the backdrop of my book and what I try to, you know, really explore is the crisis of the oceans itself, and by implication, you know, the survival of the human race. Because as we journeyed, you know, into Antarctica, and as we encountered the Japanese, and as we lost them in the fog, and as we hunted them down again, I absorbed a lot of information from the people on the ship and from books and stuff that was material that was on the boat about what is happening to our oceans. And, you know, very few people realize, you know, most of us are landlubbers. We're not mariners. We're not marine biologists. We don't know that half the coral reefs in the world are dead or dying, that we've lost 90% of our pelagic predator fish stock since 1950. The oceans are on the verge of, you know, an ecosystem-wide crisis right now.
So he still attracts attention. He's still active, and this work is still going on.
He's about to launch from Australia right now. They're preparing the two ships. He got another ship that's faster that could keep up with the Japanese fleet a little better. And so they have two ships now, and they are heading south again. Interesting point, you know, about, you know, countries seeing him as a terrorist. He flew under several flags, and, you know, Canadian, British, Belizean, 2 days out of Tasmania, again, you know, last winter, the Belize government pulled their flag, and so he was a stateless ship. They have since gotten flags from Holland, so it's interesting.
Yeah, he has the Jolly Roger up, too.
Yep, he has the Jolly Roger up. And he's
it's complicated. I hope you get great reviews and sell a lot and get a lot of attention.
Thank you very much.
It's really just basically just this man's background and the people who follow him, all of the, it's like reading Captain Cook in his, you know. Right.
Yeah, you just can't believe it. It's sort of like, you know, I mean, what I found, it's a little like, you know, the annex of Robin Hood, you know, in the modern day. It's just, it's nutty.
Maybe just, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. I don't know if you'd want to maybe talk a little bit more about his background, about Paul Watson's background, because as the caller said, he was involved in founding Greenpeace and did leave under, I guess, disputed circumstances. So he's somebody who certainly has been doing this kind of what some people would call radical environmental work for some time. What got him to that place?
Right. Interesting. Well, he grew up in Toronto and then at a little sort of very picturesque village in New Brunswick on the coast, east coast of Canada, called St. Andrews by the Sea.
I've been there.
Wow, I haven't, but I hear it's beautiful.
It is. It's kind of touristy, but it's a lovely part of the world, I think.
Right. And Watson, even though this was a fishing, you know, I guess the major industry then was lobster, and Watson did not like to, he didn't eat seafood even back when he was a kid, and he was part of the local Humane Society, and what he used to do is, trapping was big back then, he used to run the trap lines, even as a little boy, and free, you know, the fox and the raccoons and the animals that were trapped. So he was doing this very early on. He had a tough relationship with his dad. I guess he was, you know, beaten and stuff, and he would run away a lot. He was once put in a sort of a Catholic reform school for troubled youth, and the nuns, to punish him because he, you know, he just did not do well with authority, would make him sit in tubs full of ice. And so I think he sort of grew up with this idea that, you know, all the bad things that were happening came from the people in authority and the people that were running things, the local economy, the trappers were causing the suffering of the animals, his father, the church. So he grew up with a very cynical view of human authority, of religion, and I think he let, you know, I think he was probably a pretty angry young man, and I think he let his sort of intuitions about how people were using animals and the resources of the earth. He sort of let those guide him. He helped found Greenpeace when he was living out in Vancouver, and he helped found Greenpeace in 1972. And then 5 years later, Greenpeace, the Greenpeaceans say that he divested a sealer on the east coast of Canada on the ice of his seal club violently and threw it in the water. And that they realized that Watson's ideas about activism were different from theirs, and they ejected him. He says it was a political move because he didn't support this guy Patrick Moore for president of the board. So interesting how that went. But you know, he's been making waves ever since he was a kid.
There are only three nations in the world now that have commercial whaling fleets, and you, earlier in the interview you mentioned them. They are Norway, Iceland, and Japan. And that one of the countries has recently given up whaling. I think you said, I forget now, which was Iceland?
Yeah, they temporarily suspended their commercial hunt.
And this book and the focus of a lot of people's efforts is on the Japanese. It's sort of my understanding that that in Japan, whale meat didn't really become widely available until after the war, and only because people were hungry and it was cheap. And that today, it's not an important part of the Japanese diet. And in fact, that young Japanese aren't interested in eating whale. There doesn't really seem to be a great deal of demand for it in Japan. So one really wonders why it should be such a big thing for the Japanese to simply say, well, we really don't need to be killing whales. We really don't need the meat. Let's just stop doing this.
Right. It's such a great point. The Japanese started whaling on a large commercial basis after World War II, when there was protein shortages, as you said, and it was actually General MacArthur who encouraged them to do that. And they got very good at it. And nowadays, it's true, several surveys, one by the English survey company Mori, one by the Asahi newspaper in Japan, show that only 1-4% of Japanese people eat whale meat more than once a month, and only 11% of the population actually support whaling. So, you raise a really great point. I was recently, a few weeks ago, I was on a story for Men's Journal. I paddled into a cove in Taiji, Japan. It's called the Killing Cove, where still a drive hunt goes on, where the local fishermen on a daily basis between September and April drive dolphins in to this cove, whole pods of dolphins, and then they slaughter them. They kill them with spikes and spears and knives, and whole families, babies, moms, they thrash around. They take half an hour to die sometimes. The whole lagoon fills with blood. They tarp off the entire lagoon, surround it with razor wire, patrol it, because they don't want anybody to see this going on. That still goes on. 2,300 dolphins and small whales are, like pilot whales and porpoises, are killed there every year. The Japanese issue permits for almost 23,000 of these kills every year. So a huge amount of dolphins, porpoises, pilot whales are slaughtered in these coves and along the coast of Japan. This is not regulated by the IWC. That meat is then sold in local supermarkets, and because there's not much demand, it's given to school lunch programs. That meat happens to be, by independent laboratories testing in Japan, 3 to 3,500 times holds the mercury level allowed by the Japanese government. So this is a huge scandal, too. So that's another point sort of, peripheral to what you just said, which is whale meat is highly toxic. There's biomagnification. The mercury in the oceans get in plankton. The issue ripples out, but coal-fired power plants produce mercury. It gets precipitated out in the oceans, picked up by plankton. That gets picked up by small fish, bigger fish, who eat the smaller fish. It gets magnified up the food chain, and toothed whales, like dolphins, like sperm whales, are highly, highly toxic. And so it raises the question, why feed this meat to people when they don't really want it and when it's highly toxic? Some interesting articles have come out in the New York Times. A guy named Onishi wrote an article last year, and he concluded that it was a question of national pride, of sovereignty, that the Japanese feel like, if the world, if they buckle under international pressure and allow the world to tell them what to do with their whaling program, the next thing will be their fisheries. The Japanese, 40% of their protein comes from the sea. As I said, the fish stocks are declining rapidly. They're being pushed into a corner, and they don't want anybody to tell them what to do with their fisheries. And I think that's sort of the root of the problem.
We are into the point here where we have maybe about 15 minutes left or so in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Peter Heller. He's an adventure writer, longtime contributor to National Public Radio. He's contributing editor at Outside Magazine and National Geographic Adventure. He's the author of a number of books, including the book that tells the story here that we're talking about this morning, and that is The Whale Warriors. The subtitle is The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals. It's published by the Free Press. And as we have explained, this is in part the story of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and its leader, Paul Watson, a group that believes that only very serious direct action is going to save the whales and, all in a larger sense, attract people's attention to the problem of the health of the oceans and ultimately the health of the entire planet. If you're interested in reading the book, you can take a look at it. It's out of the bookstore now, and questions here are certainly welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And back in the beginning, you told a little bit about the story of how the book begins and of this trip that you were on in 2005, and you were also, I guess I should make sure that people understand, you were there on assignment working as a journalist for National Geographic. So you were along for this ride, and you talked about the fact that on the one hand, being with people that have this kind of commitment, willing to risk their lives for what they believe in, is on the one hand, I think the word you used was exhilarating. On the other hand, you recognize the fact that it was distinctly possible that the ship, the Farley Mowat, if it had been damaged seriously enough, it could have sunk, and it very possible that everybody who was on board, including you, could have been killed. How did you, at some point there, you must have thought to yourself, what the heck am I doing here?
Well, I had a little bit of an idea of what I was signing up for, but I think, as you said, I didn't really realize how serious things were going to get until the can opener went on the bow, until I heard some of the plans about, ramming ships and running out prop foulers. There was a lot of that. On the second and third engagements of the Japanese fleet, Watson's crews attempted with Zodiac small inflatable boats with outboard motors to drop prop fouling devices, that's cables, ropes with weights and buoys, alongside and in front of these ships. And the idea there was to suck up these cables and entangle the props. And in that case, a ship without a propeller in those kind of seas, has to be abandoned, because if a storm comes up, it'll flounder and sink. So, this is really, really serious. And I think, I for some reason I was never scared on that boat. I think, for one, I had a really good dry suit. And I thought, well, if we sink, I'll have at least, a few hours in the water to think about things, and hopefully, Greenpeace or someone or the Japanese themselves will come pick us up. But I think, I've been an adventure journalist for a long time. I was a kayaker, and, I paddled whitewater expeditions around the world. I think at some point, you do this stuff, you realize that, it might happen, but you are having so much, it is so exhilarating, and you just kind of have faith that, things will turn out.
We talked about the fact that back here in the mid-1980s, the International Whaling Commission put this moratorium on commercial whaling because there was a great deal of concern that a number of species, large whale species, were in fact endangered because of over-hunting that happened in the 19th and the 20th centuries. Then, as a result of concern about conditions of whales and this moratorium, then there has been some rebound now on some whale species. Certainly, the numbers of whales have increased. Is it possible to say a little bit of just about how whales are doing right at the moment?
Sure. The fin whales, the Japanese, well, I think one thing is raising, a lot of consternation around the world is that the Japanese whaling fleet just took off from Shimonoseki heading for Antarctica. They're almost there by now. And this year they're going to be hunting not only minke whales, which have, you know, relatively large populations compared to the other whale species, but they're also going to be hunting humpback whales and fin whales. Humpback whales are the, you know, the ones in the Pacific Life commercial. They have the long fins, lateral fins that look like arms, and they love to leap bodily out of the water. They're highly social. They've been found to have 622 social sounds that they make. And fin whales are the second largest mammal on the planet after blue whales, and they are endangered. They're listed as endangered both by the World Conservation Union and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So they're going after these charismatic, beloved humpback whales, which are, by the way, the staple of a $1 billion whale watching industry. And these, you know, endangered fin whales, humpback whales are threatened, in a whale sanctuary. So, you know, that's raising a lot of international consternation. Fin whales and humpback whales were both nearly driven, as you said, to extinction in the 1970s. And their populations now range, I think fins are anywhere from, some scientists say their populations could be as low as 5,000, and, you know, IWC estimates they could be up to almost 40,000. That's 5,000 to 40,000 animals in the entire planet. Humpback whales range somewhere in the 20,000 to 30,000 population. Their pre-whaling populations, now new DNA research out of Stanford and Harvard shows that their pre-whaling populations were 1.5 million. So now you have maybe 20,000 animals left. The gray whale is a great story. After the Pacific California gray whale was almost driven to near, you know, the point of extinction, and now there's something like 30,000 animals through this moratorium. Yet their cousins on the west, the western Pacific gray whale, now only number 100 or so animals. So you have you know, some of these species on the rebound, and some are still hanging on at the very edge of extinction. The problem is the great marine biologist Sylvia Earle, Dr. Sylvia Earle, who's an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, says that all whaling right now is not sustainable because these are long-lived, slow-growing animals. They are facing huge pressures now from pollution, ship strikes, from global warming and from outright hunting, pressures that, you know, they didn't have historically in their populations, and that all of them need, you know, real protection right now if they're going to survive.
Do, you know, there are special provisions for a different kind of hunting, and I'm not sure what sort of terminology you put on this, but basically this is distinct from commercial whaling, that is among people, indigenous peoples, whose forebears, you know, from time immemorial had hunted whales on a subsistence basis, mm-hmm. and that it's part, it not only is it part of their diet, it's part of their culture to do this. And so there are special rules for people like that. And I think there are people who are at least willing to draw this distinction between factory fishing and commercial hunting whales on a very large scale, and something that is different. It is smaller scale. It's a much lower tech kind of thing. And they're willing to say, in the one case, we have a problem with this, but in the other case, we think that that's okay. At least we'd have to say that that's not going to have the impact on whale populations that commercial hunting is going to have. For those people who are involved in commercial hunting, do they point at the exemptions for cultural hunting and say, well, why shouldn't, if you're going to say that these people over here can hunt whales, why is it that you're going to tell us that we can't?
Right. No, it's a great point. I mean, I think the biggest defense of Japanese whaling that officials there use is that it's a cultural tradition. Mm-hmm. And this is where you raise such a good point. You know, the cultural tradition in Japan, you know, for hundreds of years was some, you know, few coastal communities went out and got, you know, very relatively small numbers of whales, you know, in slow, very slow boats, or they drove them in and the drive fisheries into these coves and killed them that way. These are relatively small numbers of whales. They are not the 23,000 whales that are being killed coastally now in Japan, and certainly not, you know, the numbers that are hunted on with big commercial, modern, very efficient whaling fleets. So you know, the cultural tradition thing, the other point is that cultural tradition is really, you know, rooted, you know, in the past. It has to be honored. And at the same time, you know, the resources, the resource base was much different, you know, hundreds of years ago. The oceans were full of fish, as we talked about. There were many, many more whales, you know, 10, 20 times the numbers of great whales, pre-commercial whaling, modern commercial whaling. So, you know, that's when these cultural traditions were perhaps viable. But now times change. The oceans are on, as we said, you know, the verge of total ecosystem collapse. And maybe it's time for all of us to rethink, you know, how we use the oceans.
Hmm. Certainly there are other environmental groups, and Greenpeace is one of them, that has similar concerns, share the concerns of the Sea Shepherds, and are willing to take what they would call direct action, at least in the form of getting in the face of whale hunters and even putting themselves in between the whales and the whale hunters without taking it this as far as Paul Watson and the Shepherds have taken it. If those people are really, I don't know if they're actually going to want to go on the record about such a thing, but really if you ask them what they thought of Paul Watson and what he was doing, would they in fact tell you that something like, well, you know, as much as we support him in principle, that in fact what he does is does go too far, and maybe it's not particularly good for the image of the environmental movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good point. And the Greenpeace, you know, people in the, you know, people higher up in Greenpeace have outright condemned Watson's actions, and even called him a terrorist. At the same time, you know, when I described that dawn storm on Christmas morning, when Sea Shepherd came out of the fog, they passed Greenpeace's flagship, the Esperanza, very closely. As I said, you know, the Japanese fleet was just idling in the storm, and Greenpeace was right behind them. And the ship came out of the fog, and as it was passing Esperanza, all the crew on Esperanza came out onto the bridge wings and started waving. One guy was waving a Canadian flag, and they were raising their fists. So interesting, huh? I mean, you know, the crew of this ship had probably been, you know, tired of seeing whales, you know, harpooned, exploded, and slaughtered right under their noses while they zipped around in Zodiacs and waved banners. They were probably sick of that, and they were probably thinking to themselves, yeah, you know, go for it. Do whatever you can do. At the same time, in mainstream environmental movement, among mainstream big environmental organizations, there is a lot of there's a lot of skepticism about Watson, if not downright, you know, fear that he will, like you said, you know, tarnish the image of the anti-whaling movement. I think that discussion goes on. I don't think there's an answer. Hmm.
So the Sea Shepherds, they're out again. They have left to go out to this same area to do this same activity again. Where are we going to be in the weeks ahead? Do you think we're going to be hearing about them?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't think they've left port yet, but they're on the verge. They have the two ships. They're in Australia. The Japanese should be getting very close to the Antarctic ice edge right now, and Sea Shepherd is very close to launching. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting. I think with the world attention focused by the humpback whale hunt, you know, this is the species that's, you know, beloved by whale watchers around the world. I think Watson probably feels like he has a chance to really galvanize, you know, world opinion, and really raise a lot of world awareness on this campaign. So it's going to be very interesting to see how far he pushes things.
Mm-hmm. And I know that there was early in October, there were some people from Sea Shepherds in Tokyo wanting to meet with somebody from the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare, from their food safety department, to present them a petition. This actually had to, I think this had to do more with the issue of the, well, you talked earlier about the killing of dolphins and the problem that then that meat, which has a lot of mercury in it, then goes out and it goes to school kids. And apparently the government said, well, no, we won't meet with you. There was never any plan to do this, and didn't want to have anything to do with them. But you wonder whether indeed the government of Japan, will they just continue to in a sense stonewall on this and maintain the kind of policy that they have had?
Man, it's really interesting to watch because it's so, you know, it's so hurting their image, you know, in the world. I mean, the Japanese have, you know, this incredible economy. They produce a lot of the, you know, the best stuff that we use on a daily basis. They have, you know, this amazing culture. You know, when you go to Japan, I mean, I was just there covering this dolphin intervention, and I was just amazed at, you know, the sweetness of the people and the hospitality and the kindness. And so it's interesting that they would allow, you know, this issue to so, you know, blacken their image in the world when they have, you know, everything else to offer, and they have real leadership for all of us in so many realms. So I don't know. I think it's a really great question. And the issue of the mercury, I think, is you know, I think it's a big, big story, and I think you're going to see more about that because I think they're facing it. The Minamata scandal, you remember that 50 years ago? Thousands of people died from mercury poisoning, and little kids, you know, were, you know, born, you know, with terrible deformities. And, you know, I think they're facing something like this again with this dolphin meat. This dolphin meat is so, so toxic, and it's being given to kids. Mm. And so I think, you know, that's really the Achilles heel of the whole whaling program.
Well, it's a great story, and if people want to read more about it, you look for the book. It's The Whale Warriors, The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals. The book is out now. It's published by Free Press by our guest, Peter Heller. He's a longtime contributor to NPR, contributing editor at Outside Magazine and National Geographic Adventure. Peter, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.